Good afternoon and welcome to this encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today we're going to listen to a conversation I had with Kat Bohannon, an author whose unbounded curiosity and top-level skill as a researcher resulted in a book that is remarkable in its scope and rife with trenchant observations about the human experience and the human condition. It's a book that asks questions that few have thought to ask before, and which provides compelling, sometimes wild and wonderful answers about biology, evolution, and how human beings came to be the humans we have become. And by the way, it's really funny. It was a bestseller when it came out in 2023. It's now out in paperback and in a version for young adults. It's called Eve, How the Female Body Drove 200 Million Years of Human Evolution. Kat Bohannon joined me in Studio A last March. It's delightful to meet you. Welcome to the show.
Nice to meet you, too. Thanks for having me.
So the first thing I want to ask you is the nature of your degree. You have a PhD from Columbia.
So I've heard.
Yeah, and it's a subject I've never heard of, speaking of here. It's in evolution of narrative and cognition. What is that?
Good question. My advisors weren't always sure either. So I did an interdisciplinary project. I was interested in why story is so good at helping us remember things. We know story, we know narrative is a mnemonic, right? You remember things that you're told in a story much better, more accurately, more completely than if they give it to you on a list. That's just a thing, right? But we don't really know why. Actually, there's a lot of top-down models in psychology for why. And I wanted to get a little more granular. I wanted to see, well, actually, maybe this is deeply tied to how these mammalian brains perceive the world. How did that evolve? How does autonoetic consciousness come up? Sorry for y'all that don't know what the hell that is. It's all right.
Count me among them.
Yes, sir. Yeah. How do we think of ourselves in the world? How do we remember our lives? How do we story ourselves? And how does that relate to this weird information technology we humans have called narrative? So that was what I did. I wrote a lot of computer programs. That's the short end of it.
Yeah. You know, I once entered, and I've mentioned this, so listeners, you've heard this before. My apologies. Years ago, I interviewed E.L. Doctorow, and he talked about the importance of stories. And he says, stories propose life as something of moral consequence. Mm. And that's how we figure out what our sort of moral framework is. Mm. And this book actually is a lot about, you know, the decisions we make, the values we have. It's about sexism.
Sure.
It's about the ignoring of women in science.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, it really is. The premise of this, it basically is that, you know, the study of women has been ignored. And it's not just in clinical trials.
Yes.
I mean, it's much more pervasive, right?
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, there is the central problem for a long time in the biological sciences where we simply weren't studying females. That went on for decades, right? Where the way to control for the messiness of estrus, the menstrual cycle, was simply to just study bodies that didn't have them and then pretend bodies were Mr. Potato Heads, that we could just kind of say, well, if you have an ovary, I guess maybe we're not sure, but cool though, here's a rat that doesn't have them. Now we understand diabetes. Wait a minute. No. Actually, we need to understand the full sex spread. So that was a thing that we're finally starting to fix. And you're absolutely right that when it comes to human clinical trials, we are finally starting to diversify our subjects. We're finally starting to get different kinds of bodies in there so that our medicine can be more individualized. Sure. Still the case, though, even after many of the wins we've had, only 22% of phase one clinical trial subjects are female. And we're a little bit more of the population than that. So there's a lot to do still. There's a lot to do.
But something like 80% of the medical decisions that are made in the United States are made by women.
Yes.
That's a funky dichotomy, isn't it?
Exactly. It's a paradox that actually really matters in our lives. While female bodies everywhere are understudied and by just about any measure undercared for, we are also, meanwhile, the deciders, right? Here we are caring not only for children, but also making medical decisions for spouses, for aging parents, for relatives, for that one friend who always has that one thing going on, right? We make more than 80%, as you say, of the medical decisions in America. We also pick up more than 90% of the prescription medication. That's the thing. We're the one who go and then make sure that happens. So here we are. We're the main deciders. And yet when it comes to our own bodies, we're a little left in the dark, but we are starting to fix it.
Kat Bohannon is my guest. Her book is How the Female Body Drove 200 Million Years of Human Evolution. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. So you describe this book as a kind of user's manual for the female mammal, right?
Yeah.
And you really dig deep into how things work and why they evolved over a long period of time.
A little tic-tac of time. Yeah.
To work the way they are working. Now, is this kind of approach, are these kinds of questions being asked widely in science? I mean, I'm not a scientist, so
yeah.
I mean, this book seems, first of all, it's unlike any other book I've ever read, and I really enjoyed it. I was really compelled by it.
Oh,
but
thanks.
I just wonder, since I'm a dummy when it comes to science, are other people thinking about this too? Do you have a lot of peers?
Absolutely. I'm part of a wave more than anything. I would not credit myself by any means as the only person who's thought of this. My book wouldn't exist if it weren't for the actual thousands of amazing scientists and clinicians who've been working hard in this space. I mean, the thing to know is that this is an interdisciplinary book, just like in my own work, I'm interdisciplinary. So it's pulling on dozens of different bodies of knowledge. So even when you have someone who is like, I don't know, an expert in monkey lactation, who I went up and talked with up at Harvard, that was Katie Hind back in the day. She, you know, knows a ton about mammalian lactation, but she's not thinking a whole lot about deep evolutionary things, right? And you have your paleoanthropologists who know a lot about hominins, but they're not thinking about milk. You know, so being able to stitch all of that together was really, really the job there.
The book you title Eve,
yeah.
But in fact, it's about a bunch of different kinds of Eves, because you talk about the origins of female mammals,
yeah.
But you don't start at like two-legged, two-armed creatures. You go way, way, way back. I mean, when you talk about milk, it's a ancestor you call Morgi, a cross between a weasel and a mouse.
I mean, the
pictures in the first few chapters of this book are really surprising because they don't look anything like human females.
Yeah.
They look like rodents.
Well, you know, the funny thing about Morgi and about rodents is how darn similar they really are and were, right? The reason we study rats in a lab isn't just that they make babies fast, which in science is useful, right? Because you're trying to study things over generations. Well, it helps if your generations don't take many years to make, so that's a thing. It's also not that we don't like rats. That isn't why we do it, to make it more morally acceptable. I mean, like when I was in grad student housing at Columbia, look, there was a time when I saw a rat crawl out of my toaster. That did happen. I did throw away the toaster, which is the only right decision in that scenario.
Right. Don't need a plumber at this point. Right?
No. And I absolutely didn't set out rat traps either because we didn't have roaches. And that's because rats eat roaches. And in New York, you make decisions. You know, you just have to make that call. But in studying rats in the lab, the reason we do is there's this idea of the conservation of traits. In other words, the reason you can build a reasonable model, we call it a rodent model, a murine or a rat model, or a mouse model of diabetes in a mouse is because there's going to be analogs in our bodies because we are also mammals, right? So in that way, when you look in the mirror, you're really looking at this thing that's kind of exploding backward through time, right? Your digestive system is radically old. Your brain, or at least the prefrontal cortex bit, pretty recent, kind of a recent upgrade and about as buggy as you would expect for a recent upgrade, right? And so if I wanted to tell the story about how female mammals work, I had to go look back to, well, where did this trait evolve? Where did this come from? So Morganicodon, Morgi, I call her Morgi because the Smithsonian does, and in the field they do. She's this adorable little she-weasel, so to speak, and she lived under the feet of dinosaurs, and that's why we have breasts. That chick, living in burrows, lactating, still laying eggs, weirdly, just like the duck-billed platypus still does. But she lactates, and it's like, okay, so what were the conditions that led to that? What were the benefits? How is that legacy still here now?
And you talk about, you know, Morgy was the first person to lactate.
Kind of a person.
Or the first being, yeah, right,
yeah,
person's
yeah.
the rubber. But you look back at the first being to lay eggs mm-hmm. inside her body.
Yes.
Instead of in a nest,
yeah,
you know, and the whole way that human birth, you know, female birth evolved, you
yeah.
know, the first people to why it is that we run around on two legs, you know, and why
yeah.
we're not very good at running around on two legs.
Yeah. Like, who can we blame for this, really? That's
right.
a primary urge. Maybe it's because my family's from New York, you know. I'm like, who do I need to be mad at right now because birth sucks, you know? And yeah, that was Protangulatum Dom. So the last common ancestor then of our live birthing uterus. You know, we stopped laying eggs outside. We weirdly turned our bodies into this kind of meat factory fever dream of an eggshell / nest. And that's what it is to gestate, which is still a terrible idea. I don't recommend it. Really, I would love to lay on a clutch of eggs. That would be clutch, as we say. That would be great. But no, we're stuck with this.
That's right. Don't try this at home, yeah. ladies and gentlemen. You make the assertion that the single most important human invention
oh, yeah.
is gynecology.
Uh-huh.
So make the argument.
Okay. So when I say gynecology, I don't just mean the terrible things we did to American black women for a century that then led to what we now know of as gynecology. Everyone, please remember Anarcha. And if you don't know about her, just Google Anarcha. You're going to find a wild story there. So gynecology involves all of the things that we do then, all the way back into our deep ancestral state, to influence female fertility, to upregulate it or downregulate it as needed. But most importantly, it's all the things we do to try and intervene on female bodies to help them survive and thrive despite the frankly wonky reproductive system we've got. Our births and our pregnancies and births and postpartum recoveries are longer and harder and more prone to dangerous and potentially crippling and sometimes deadly complications than they are for almost any other primate. Well, except for a squirrel monkey, and we do feel real bad for her. You know, when she gives birth, her offspring is 18% of her body weight. And if you're not into math, I'll let you look up what that means. It's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's so much, right? So we're sad for her. But in general, the idea is like, wait, if this is our condition, if our basic condition is actually we have challenges in our reproduction, birthing bodies do hard stuff, well, we should not be the great candidates for evolutionary fitness. That's a hard problem. We should not be the poster child for definitely going to live in every environment on Earth. No, we should be a curiosity in someone else's zoos. We know that. We see endangered animals now. They all have difficulties with reproduction. More than likely, it's also because we endanger things by being jerks, but fine. Right? So in that case, well, then it really matters for the story of humanity that we invented midwifery. And as far as most paleoanthropologists think about it, we think we did it 3.2 million years ago, back with Lucy, the Australopithecine. She had a narrow pelvis and big babies, and she probably needed help giving birth. And so that's fundamental to how we are a success.
And it was another woman-like.
Well, she was
being,
furry. We assume yeah. she was still covered in fur. She was very chimpy, but she walked on two legs. And mm-hmm. she had that same obstetric dilemma. She had that same problem of, well, what eventually in our species turned into trying to squeeze a watermelon-sized thing out of a lemon-sized hole.
Yeah.
So if you've met fruit, you understand that that is a problem.
And as you write in the book, there's 8 billion of us on
yes.
this planet. And that's not only impressive, it's actually unlikely given how fraught this process of birthing is.
It's absolutely right. Now, for any of your listeners who are pregnant, you're probably going to be fine. Go to your prenatal appointments. It's all good. The majority of pregnancies can be within this frame as healthy as possible. Pregnancy isn't a disease, but it is innately risky. It is innately costly to anybody that goes through it the way that we do. And so to have a whole species succeed with those conditions, well, you need your workarounds, and you need that workaround way more than you need a wheel or fire or even that little stone axe. The best use of that little stone axe was probably cutting an umbilical cord.
And there are other mammals who do the same kind of thing, but they reproduce much at much lower rates, right? I mean, there's 8 billion human beings, but there's like not nearly that many monkeys or bonobos or whatever. I mean, and they all have a similar process, right?
Well, or is... kind of. Let me put it to you this way. I learned this from reading into Jane Goodall's work. All right, so the average first-time human mom giving birth, top to bottom, start of contractions to baby, is 12 to 16 hours. All right? So fun times, good times. Again, hope your birthing scenario is what you want it to be. Get help wherever you want it. Thankfully, in this country, that is very much available. Not in all countries, right? But first-time chimp mom, top to bottom, birth to baby, it's about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
She gives birth and she knuckle walks away. You know, she's fine, right? And that is not our scenario. That doesn't mean we need to be fearful about it. That's not an antinatalist position. It's just kind of like, oh no, actually we're real kind of bad at this in a way that's not true of our closest cousins.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Midday. My guest is the author, poet, and researcher Kat Bohannon. We're talking about her book, Eve, How the Female Body Drove 200 Million Years of Human Evolution. We'll hear more of my conversation with Kat Bohannon on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to this encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, we're listening to a conversation I had earlier this year with the author and researcher Kat Bohannon. We're talking about her best-selling book, Eve, How the Female Body Drove 200 Million Years of Human Evolution. Bohannon makes the case that human evolution is fundamentally the story of female evolution. And she asks questions like, why do women live longer than men? And is sexism useful for evolution? Because our program was recorded earlier, we're not taking any calls or online comments today. Here's more of my conversation with Kat Bohannon. So, Kat, I want to talk about the difference between sex and gender.
Ooh,
because that is very much in the news.
Mm.
So how many sexes are there? How many genders are there? Is there a count that anybody's done?
It's actually kind of a definitional problem in the sciences. Now, I'm talking about when you're doing medical research or in these sorts of spaces, right? So the way we talk about it when we do research is often not the same way that we talk about it when we're having public conversations. If you're at Thanksgiving dinner, if you're trying to have a cross-generational conversation. These are different modes, right? So, for example, there's absolutely a big hump of standard physical traits if you're male, and that is true when you're female. But there are long tails and there are overlaps, and it kind of depends which tissue in the body you're looking at, weirdly. For example, in your brain, there are absolutely some likelihoods that one region of your brain or another will have a sex-typical trait, right? But weirdly, in the exact same brain in another region, you may well have typical of the other sex happening. It's really more of a mosaic in that organ, and that is way less true of other regions of your body. So the body then is this amalgam of lots of different stuff, some of which is more influenced by sex than others.
So to say that, you know, XX is one, we're talking about chromosomes, is one sex, XY is another sex.
Sure.
Is that most of the time? True.
Mm-hmm. Most of the time. How about that? Most of the time. But it's really kind of like, what does that get you? You need to do the analysis if you're not studying XX bodies to see where it's really driving something, right? But you're also going to be making deep assumptions about XX being the same across the lifespan because, for example, in immunology, an 11-year-old female doesn't have that same immunological pattern as a female that is in the middle of a gestation. And likewise might have some different features in that immune system from a postmenopausal person, right? So it's sort of like, which question do you want? In the sciences, we're always like, it's all about what question you're trying to ask, right? Whereas in other spaces, it might be different. Now, when it comes to gender, I can also say there's this interesting kind of Myopia. There's this way where we assume that the way we do something that seems really fundamental in human culture now must have always been the case. You know what I mean? And I don't just mean like Western-centric. I mean the fact that our species is 300,000 years old, just our species. And then there's the pre-human and, oh my goodness, right? So what on earth this idea of gender would have meant in one or another human culture 100,000 years ago? I don't think we have any idea. I do think that what we are fundamentally is culture makers and culture innovators. So that's a space we're going to innovate. You know, I don't think it's surprising at all that we're interrogating this idea of gender and what is or isn't necessary if you're a woman, what is or isn't necessary if you're a man. I think we've probably always done stuff like that. We just pretend that these are recent questions.
I'm sure the political conversation about that at this moment is a whole other deal than a scientific conversation. You mentioned a skeleton named Ardi, who was found in Ethiopia, and you say she's the reason that there are men's and women's divisions of competitive sports, and that is a particularly fraught issue right as we speak. So in what way?
Well, let's just go ahead and put a pin in this to understand the idea of rarity here in the United States. If I am remembering right, in collegiate sports, there are roughly 10 or 12 trans athletes that are registered out of a couple hundred thousand. So when we think about what is a major issue, I think a lot of people in sports do not think of this as a major issue. It's just we've made political hay of it. And is there an evil in that? Oh, yes. Oh, yes, there is. Are we surprised that someone might use a vulnerable population to try to get ahead in politics? Well, we're in Baltimore right now. That's real close to D.C. I don't think that's surprising to anybody. Okay. Now, I will say in sports, though, what's interesting about Ardi, she's this moment we were finally for sure bipedal, means walking on two legs, right? And the thing about walking upright that's weird and interesting is it's actually a kind of constant daily endurance sport. It's hard to stand up on a long-evolved body that should look a bit more like a table with four legs, right, and haul it up on its back end. And this, of course, is why we have lower back issues as a species. This, of course, is why we have bad knees. This is why orthopedic surgeons make so much money. This is the root of it all, right? But what's interesting about that endurance question is by many measures, typical female bodies seem better geared for endurance, right? We're better at going the long haul, whether you're talking about how our muscle cells are utilizing different kinds of energy sources, right? Whether you're flipping from your carbohydrate to your protein, that idea of tapping into a second wind, right? That's a thing that's your muscles are starting to utilize a different energy source. Female bodies are a little better at it. And in the long tail influence of that, you can see that when it comes to ultra marathons, female runners often outpace and win when it comes to their male counterparts.
Yeah, so it's kind of almost sport specific.
Mm-hmm.
You write a lot about transgendered people in this book, and you say trans women are women because their brains produce the experience of identifying as a woman. So gender has a lot to do with how your brain categorizes and figures things out, not so much your physiognomy otherwise?
Presumably. I mean, let me also say, having read into the science quite a bit, we actually don't know why someone like me, a cisgendered chick, identifies as a woman. We don't know what the mechanisms are that drive that whole experience, right? I know that I do. I know in part, and so many of us kind of self-interrogated in that moment where trans visibility got bigger and trans advocacy got more normal, right? Many of us kind of were like, well, how do I feel about my gender? Which is kind of a weird question that, frankly, I'd never asked myself before. I'd say that most women actually have kind of a fraught relationship with our gender because it's all embedded in sexism and it's kind of complicated to live in the world where, you know, right? But I'm like, no, actually, yeah, I identify as a woman. Yep. And part of the reason I knew that was so deeply true was that I found I didn't care very much. Every trans and non-binary person I know cares deeply, has strong feelings about their gender, and that has been true throughout their whole lives. My neutrality is a pretty good signal that I just identify as a woman, and that's it, and there it is. And for them, it's more of a complicated experience. But yes, you're absolutely right. The assumption is that it's brain-based, but that doesn't mean it's not real. Your brain is an organ. That football of tissue you're carrying around in your head is an organ like any other. So what it does is, by definition, natural.
The book is Eve, How the Female Body Drove 200 Million Years of Human Evolution. The author is my guest, Kat Bohannon. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. The notion of women in combat is another thing that's been in the news. The current Secretary of Defense doesn't think it should happen. And you write about that it turns out female bodies in a unit in combat may actually bring advantages to that unit. And it's certainly by no means the case that it's automatically a disadvantage.
Well, I don't know that Mr. Secretary has read my book. I'm going to assume that he has not. I do think it's the case. Now, I have cousins in the military. I have a cousin who was a tank platoon head for decades before he went into JAG. He gave me some insight into what it's like to have mixed sex units, because he's been around. And in his word, it's a nothing burger. It's just, you know, we make a lot of hay of it in public, but when it actually comes to the solidarity of the group on the ground, this thing that we used to call and sometimes still call brotherhood in a space like the Marines, which really does matter. The cohesion of your group really does matter in a forward-facing unit in the theater. That's a thing. It doesn't seem to be negatively impacted by presence of female members. If anything, it seems neutral or occasionally better.
Yeah, and in terms of bonding and stuff, there's...
Yeah, exactly.
People have actually studied this, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. The Marines themselves put out a huge study on this, and indeed, because they were among the most anxious about the idea, of course. And indeed, no, it did not produce major problems in the way that everyone feared it would, which is interesting.
The notion that men and women are different. I mean,
yes.
you write about the differences.
Sure.
Women respond to opioids differently.
Mm-hmm.
Women are smarter. Girls are smarter than boys. But then when puberty starts, or at least they test better, and then when puberty starts, that difference kind of evaporates. There are, you know, and this notion about, is there a female brain that's different than the male brain?
Yeah, yeah.
So when we talk about the brain saying as an organ, you know, I identify as a woman even though I have male, you know, physiological characteristics, it's not that there aren't differences, right?
Sure.
Differences is always going to be part of it.
I mean, if you think about stuff like an evolutionary biologist, you quickly arrive at the very natural conclusion that diversity is a feature, not a bug, right? That actually monocultures tend to be the first to fall in environmental challenges. That if you are looking at a species like Homo sapiens, which naturally have many different cultural differences, many different physical differences, many different subsets of populations, right? Actually, it tends to be true that the more diverse populations are more stable, they are more robust, they're more likely to be able to respond to challenges. And so I think it must surely be the case that if it is rare but common enough to have an unusual set of life experiences with identifying as one gender or another, that shouldn't be thought of as somehow a flaw in the system. It sounds like human beings being human beings.
But you're right that the oddest thing about our species might be that the female human brain doesn't seem to be all that functionally different than the male human brain. Why is that odd?
So if you take a couple of mice and you expose them to some pheromones, pro tip, this is actually usually by having them smell the pee of one or another. There's a lot of pee-based language, effectively pee-based signaling if you're a mouse. That's a big part of your experience. Anyway, I'm glad that's not us. Right. So if you do that in a lab, you're going to get really strong automatic responses, right? You're going to see a brain behaving in a very sexed way in response to a stimuli, right? And you don't actually get that that as much in males versus female humans. And likewise, behaviorally, you don't see these strong sets of cognitive behaviors that are obvious strengths or obvious weaknesses, which you sometimes do encounter in other mammals. Which is to say, what's weird and interesting about human brains is that we seem to have evolved towards more of a sex sameness when it in terms of what our brains can do across the board than sex differences. And the reason I find that really interesting is because when you think about it, God, it's so obvious, right? If part of our major strength is being clever and problem solving and innovating and forming social bonds and, you know, all the crap we do with our brains, why on earth would we produce a species where one half of us is innately worse at it? That does not make any sense at all. If this is how we survive, then whatever deep mechanical differences there may or may not be, that produce things like different responses to antidepressants or what have you, right? That your major outcome in the end is going to be a functional sameness. We're going to do mostly the same stuff with our brains because evolution rewarded that.
Yeah, and evolution's about survival. And we wouldn't survive if it were not the case.
When it comes to the long game of deep time, don't die. That's your goal. That's your goal. Just keep not dying. And that's usually a pretty safe bet.
Yeah. Let's go to the phone. Sandra is on the line with in Owings Mills. Sandra, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. So I'm not great at talking, so I hope this doesn't come across as argumentative. But and if it does, I apologize in advance. But women are not chicks. Now, some chicks are male and some chickens are female, but as a species, like Homo sapiens, women are not chicks and men are not chicks. You're talking about a whole different species.
I seem to have pissed you off. Sorry about that. I do use a lot of colloquial language when I talk.
Yeah.
It's true. My family's from New York. We're kind of sassy. We're kind of this way. And I have this, actually at this point, kind of old-fashioned way of saying something like chicks. People of my generation often don't. It makes me sound oddly older.
All right. Well, appreciate your perspective, Sandra. Thanks for the call. Speaking of chicks, I want to ask you about an event called, I think it's pronounced Chicxulub. An asteroid that was which was 6 miles wide hit the Earth with a force that you say exceeds 1 billion Hiroshimas. I mean, that's incredible.
Yes.
And then it ended up making the Earth very cold for a long, long time, tens of thousands of years. And then this is the kind of connection you draw in this book, which is the last thing I would have thought you would connect. But you say somewhere in this ash fall is the reason women have periods.
Yep.
How do you get from an ash fall and an asteroid that's 6 miles wide to the menstrual cycle? That's wild.
It is wild, and it was a lot of fun writing about it. I mean, the central reason, so we're talking about the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs. Now, there is some controversy. Maybe it was also a bunch of volcanic explosion. Maybe it was a tipping point. It doesn't matter. It was pretty much the asteroid, all right. The asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs, or at least most of them, birds still are avian dinosaurs, and they're still kind of pissed about it, right? Or as much as any average sparrow can get pissed about things. The reason the world changed is a giant rock hit the planet, okay? And it changed our atmosphere, it changed our biosphere, it changed the trajectory of life on Earth. And one of the big things it did, weirdly, is it wiped out more of the ancestors of today's marsupials than the ancestors of mammals like you and me, which are these eutherian live birthing placentals. So what that meant is there were a couple different ways that our uterus could have gone in deep time, because this organ we have, it evolved over time, and for reasons that are unclear, our way of going about it produced all of the species that we have now that are mammals. And, well, the marsupials, way to remember is pouch or no pouch. Marsupials have the pouch, okay? Marsupials are mostly isolated to Australia and a little bit of South America, right? The way we go about it is we're able to gestate our babies inside our bodies for a long time. which is different than a marsupial. They finish it out on the pouch. And what's weird and interesting about that is that it has huge knock-on effects in the female that are long evolved. Because once you're in there for a long time, drawing resources from the mother's body, you're influencing her immune system, you're influencing her cardiovascular system, renal, hepatic, so your liver, your kidney. There's no part of a body that's pregnant in mammals like us. There's no part of a body that's pregnant in mammals like us that isn't pregnant. Your brain is effectively pregnant. Your heart is pregnant. Your lungs, your kidneys. It's all of it, right? And so looking at those deep knock-on effects is a big part of how you would want to understand how female bodies evolve in our species.
If you've just joined us, this is an encore presentation of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're listening to a conversation I had with the author and researcher Kat Bohannon about her book, Eve, How the Female Body Drove 200 Million Years of Human Evolution. We'll have more with Kat Bohannon on the other side of a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're listening to a conversation I had last March with Kat Bohannon, an author, poet, and researcher who, in 2023, published a best-selling book about the story of human evolution and how that story has heretofore usually excluded the central role of women. She calls the book a kind of user's manual for the female mammal, which she divides into one-word chapters that trace the origins of the defining features of being female. Here's what they are: milk, womb, perception, legs, tools, brain, voice, menopause, and love. And she explains in layperson terms how women's bodies have animated our collective development. Her insights are often hilarious, and her curiosity is unbounded. This is a terrific book. It's called Eve, How the Female Body Drove 200 Million Years of Human Evolution. It's now available in paperback and in a version for young adults. Here's more of my conversation with Kat Bohannon. Let's talk about menopause, which is, you talk a lot about it in the book. You say that human menopause is one of the biggest mysteries in modern biology, right up there with why we die.
Yep.
Is why we die a mystery, too? I didn't realize that. I thought
kind
of what happens at the end.
Well, your cells are, well, at different rates, but they're kind of constantly replicating, right? That's just part of how we go about this messy business of being biological beings. You have cells, they replicate, your tissues maintain themselves, fine. In principle, in theory, that should be able to go on forever, right? And the fact that it does not is actually a fairly big mystery in biology. But the mystery of menopause is simply this. Now, for those of your listeners who are new to this idea, okay, I have not gone through menopause, full disclosure, but I know folk who have. Okay. Menopause is effectively, by definition, you have stopped ovulating, but then you go on to live basically a full third of your potential lifespan after that point. Which is to say, menopause means you're not dead. Congratulations, lady. That's actually the only real thing to know about menopause. You're not dead yet. That's how it's defined. And yet, weirdly, your
ovaries have stopped. And are you dead yet in other species when you can stop reproducing?
Exactly.
Then that's the end of the line.
Yeah. Most, is it most? I believe most other species, they reproduce or have the capacity to reproduce up until they kick the bucket, right? So this is a weird thing. And in fact, the only confirmed cases of menopause are human beings and I think it's four species of toothed whale. It's really, you know, it's unusual. We only learned that because, well, frankly, it's hard to study things that live in the ocean. It's big. We can't breathe down there. Fine. Right. So we know that orca, so that's your killer whales. We know that not even all of them, but some of them have menopause. There's maybe this one troop of chimps that has menopause in Africa right now. It's maybe just those. We don't know what's up with those chicks. But anyway, but the idea is that, okay, so why stop making babies? Why would you stop with the ovulating? And one of the things that I found that was so interesting when I was digging into the research for that chapter is that it seems unlikely to be the case that it was selected for because we wanted extra childcare. Now, this is called the grandmother hypothesis, the idea that grandmas exist because if she's not busy with her own kids, she can totally help you with yours. Now, mine are being watched after by my mother-in-law literally right now back in Seattle. So I do respect this incredibly sacred role and I do not take it for granted. Hi, Mom, I love you. Right? But it is not the case that orca do that. So in matriarchal menopausal orcopods, those killer whales, when times are hard, those matriarchs are leading the pod to rare cases of better food. They're also really important for teaching younger generations special ways to hunt, but they don't seem to take care of the kids, grandkids more. It's not the case that they're giving more food to those little pups. It's not the case that they're free childcare, right? That doesn't seem to be the point at all. So in other words, maybe we didn't evolve to shut down our ovaries. Maybe we simply, in species that have it like this, evolved to keep living, and the ovaries never got the message.
And of course, some of those people in menopause are also the ones helping with the births, too.
Yes, it's absolutely the case that older people are useful. Okay, great. We could just leave that sentence there, right?
I feel better already, Kat.
See?
That's good.
Yeah, absolutely. You have a value in society. We have deeply interdependent and interconnected societies. It is absolutely the case that people who live on continue to be deeply valuable, sometimes precisely for their wisdom, for what they can remember. That would have been true of our ancestors, too.
How the female body drove 200 million years of human evolution. Eve is the book. That's what we're talking about with Kat Bohannon. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Let's talk a little bit about love and monogamy. It's the last chapter of the book and how monogamy came to be a thing.
For some of us, sometimes.
Yeah. But you started, or you say that some of this started essentially with, for lack of a better word, prostitution. I mean, it was trading sex for meat or protection or something. It might be a kind of a loose use of the word prostitution, or maybe I'm misunderstanding what you wrote. But the fact that, generally speaking, we connect with one other person and stick to that person, how has that helped evolution?
Well, I will go ahead and say that this was a dominant idea in many different disciplines of science that thought about this kind of stuff, about mating strategies, its connection to humans, all of that, that we have this weird pair bonding, which is very different than what chimps do, very different from what bonobos do. They're what we're most closely related to, so we always look to them. Whether or not we're like them, we don't know, but we look to them, right, in primatology. Like, was it because females needed extra protection? Was it because females wanted some extra meat, as it were, for their meat? Right? So the idea that you could trade exclusivity with one partner and then that would be rewarded. And I think I say in the book, I actually find this a very dubious prospect. I am largely unsold in this topic space, in part because one of the reasons, or at least we think one of the reasons, chimps have sex with just about everybody is not just because they're horny, though also, and I support that in chimps, but because you get paternal uncertainty. You don't know who the hell the dad is if you're hanging out with everybody, as it were, right? And that's important because there's such a thing as infanticide in many primate species. So one of the ideas about paternal uncertainty is it's a strategy to not be exclusive, because then you're far less likely to have your kid killed by a guy who's like, well, that's not my kid, right?
So the paternal uncertainty leads to danger for the kid. Because
paternal certainty leans to danger for the kid. Knowing who the dad is, now again, everybody, I'm not talking about right now here in Baltimore, I'm talking about our ancestral state. So paternal certainty, knowing who the dad is, means that that child is not the genetic offspring of known fathers, potential fathers. You know, there's this one guy and we know that, okay. Supposedly, if that's possible to know. I don't know. So if that's the case, then it is absolutely true that it'd be totally fine, I mean, in chimp morality, not ours, to kill that kid to make you fertile again sooner because you're no longer lactating, and lactating is an ovulation suppressant. Breastfeeding delays how long you're going to be fertile. So if you have a breastfeeding kid, you are not useful, as it were, for propagating the genes of this other guy. So if he doesn't know if that kid's his, again, this is not a model for how human beings should behave. But if you think about how mating patterns evolve, you have to say, okay, what were the rewards? What were the costs? I think that a flipped monogamy, if it were a flip, if that's something we shifted to, would have not necessarily been a great deal for the females. I think actually it could have been very costly for her for a long time.
You talk about sexism.
I do.
A lot in this book. Mm. And the fact that it is costly. It is costly to global health. In what ways?
Oh, God.
In
just
a million
about
ways.
Every way you could measure, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it. Look, so one of the things I propose in the book is that, okay, our species came to be because gynecology. Okay, fine. The flip side of gynecology, which is a behavioral suite, the flip side is sex rules, right? So there's this subset of sexism in any culture that you look at. And I don't just mean when people treat you like jerks. I just mean like what are the cultural norms for how females are supposed to be that are deeply about controlling access to female bodies. Like there is nothing in your genes that says how long your skirt should be. That's not a thing. But there might be something in human behavior that makes us have a drive to create rules that control access to female bodies. Now, there could be more or less. There's no one set of rules that's basic to us, right? But if you are controlling access to female bodies, where she can go in a day, who she can talk to, and God knows all the rules around the actual sexing, right? Then you're controlling her fertility. And if fertility is dangerous innately because of how we go about making babies, well, then innovating around how fertility happens could be advantageous. So we keep innovating on these rules. In every known human culture, past and present, there are strong rules that control access to female bodies, right? And that's the flip side. So I think that's what sexism innately was supposed to do back in the day. And maybe it had given us advantages. But gynecology is so much better at keeping females alive now. Oh my goodness, it's vastly outpaced it. Sexism, which reduces access to gynecology, in fact, makes more women and girls die.
And there is a huge cultural, sociological implication for, as you say, the whole notion of how gynecology has advanced the species. For example, wet nurses who are able to, you know, keep babies alive in these very interesting ways are the reason we have cities.
Yes, I know. Wasn't that fun?
That's terrific.
It was crazy. So, right. So there's a lot of, this is talking about ancient demography, if you want to know. So in other words, how did human cities come to be in long ago history? Well, everyone talks about agriculture, people talk about trade, people talk about disease issues with that many people living close to each other. How did that come to be? If you've ever read Sapiens, he has some theories, right? But the main thing that very few people talk about is the fact that when you breastfeed, you ovulate less often. And if you stop breastfeeding early, you ovulate sooner. So if you have someone else breastfeed your kid, you make more babies.
Kat Bohannon. Her book is called Eve, How the Female Body Drove 200 Million Years of Human Evolution. This is a terrific book, and it's been fun talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
This has been an encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening on the radio or online. I appreciate it. Have a great day.